Enthused by your compassion, in order to rid us of all the distorted views, you taught the holy Dharma. I pay homage to you, Gautama. The Buddhas do not wash away the sins of the sentient beings, nor do they take away the suffering of sentient beings, nor do they shift their realizations into the sentient beings, but only by showing the truth they liberate sentient beings. And so the Buddha is someone who is only intent on helping sentient beings. So how it is done is not by washing away the sins of sentient beings within the sins which are within the mind stream of sentient beings, and then also which results in suffering, the negative actions, the contaminant actions. So in other words, the cause, the origin of suffering cannot be washed away, nor the suffering can be taken away by his hands, nor do the can the Buddhas actually gift us their realizations, as we say, becoming enlightened in one instant. So this may be possible. It's a very rare possibility. For someone who is acquainted with the whole path for many lifetimes, maybe such instant realization of a time enlightenment may be possible. But the way the Buddha helps us is by showing us the path, what to adopt and what to discard. And then this is what we need to practice and make our transformation within. And so for that, we have in the Tibetan translation, we have Ganjur and Denjur. For example, the Ganjur has over 100 volumes in Tibetan, and then maybe Chinese. We have many texts, for example, regarding Avatamsaka Sutra. In Tibetan, we have 6 volumes, whereas it seems that in Chinese there are more volumes. And so these actually teach us the paths and what we need to adopt and what we need to discard, the right and wrong practices. And then, and whether we call it the essence of the teaching or written in concise manner or made explication of the teachings of the Buddha, we have the writings of Master Nagarjuna and his disciples and so forth. And so we have in Tibetan translation Denjur collection, which comprises over 200 volumes. And so Buddhism is about practicing by ourselves and disciplining our mind. And that is done by seeing reason to do so. It's not done, rather, foolishly, stubbornly. So especially in today's world, when we have all kinds of information coming, it's not going to work if we just be stubborn, but without seeing the reason. So, regarding the Tibetan tradition, we have great writings of Tibetan masters. So, the style of writing of Tibetan masters and Indian masters are different. George Atisha wrote The Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment after coming to Tibet, as requested by Chang Chubhu, the Tibetan chieftain at that time, who requested that Atisha give a teaching which is beneficial to the whole of Tibet. And so Atisha wrote this text for the benefit of general Tibetans in general, where there was not so much study of Buddhism at that time. And so he couldn't write this text for beings with sharp faculty as such, but for people in general. And therefore, it was particularly written for Tibetans in Tibet, whereas the writings of Indian masters generally were written within the milieu of various traditions that were extant in India in those days. And so there were non-Buddhist and philosophical traditions and so forth, and so which actually posed challenges to the Buddhists, and therefore within that kind of environment the Indian masters wrote their texts in India. And so the situation of writing these books in Tibet and India were different. And so, with regard to Shantideva's Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, it is a great and incredible text for practice. But even in there is in the ninth chapter, the chapter on wisdom, there are mentions of or criticisms of the non-Buddhist traditions. Of course, Shantideva's main objective was not criticizing non-Buddhist traditions as such. But because there were such traditions in India, and he wrote in that manner, because there were people who were not fond of Buddhism, not admirers of Buddhism as such. So in the past, Tibetan masters wrote within the environment in Tibet, but today the situation has changed with us, and it will be different in the future as well. And so we see lots of material developments, and people are attracted towards the material progress these days. And so we find that the physical pains and problems are more urgent than the mental ones. And so we see food, clothing, and so forth are more urgent for us. And so the future Tibet will be like that. And therefore, with regard to Buddhism, I usually, when I explain Buddhism, first I give an introduction to Buddhism. And so once you are introduced, once you become clear, and then I give teachings on the practice, how to go about with the practice of Buddhism. So please keep this in mind. Think about it. And so having understood what Buddhism is about, and then when you actually become interested and you actually come to believe in the teachings. So, for example, in the very beginning of the Lamrim text, it goes through the point of the benefit of relying on Guru. Because it says that by relying on a guru, one is closer to enlightenment. So someone who has no interest, no understanding of the Buddha, Buddhism, and to someone like that, if you say Lamrim is actually bringing you closer to enlightenment, doesn't make much sense. And therefore, we need to put ourselves in perspective of the broader broader perspective of the structure, the whole structure of Buddhism. And therefore, Master Nagarjuna says, all the Buddha's teachings are based on the two truths. And so within the context of the two truths, the Buddha gave has given teachings, his teachings. And therefore, in the Madhyamaka Avatara by Chandrakirta, which we all have memorized, so with the wings of conventional and ultimate wings spread widely, the bodhisattvas collect the two accumulations of merit and wisdom and then cross the further shore, reach the further shore of this samsara, which means omniscient state of Buddhahood. And therefore, before this verse, the verse preceding it, so the and so His Holiness is trying to look for the text, the verse which preceded that, the one he recited. In other words, what it says is that by thinking about the dependent origination, the reality of dependent origination, when you are able to see things as illusion-like, and then you'll be able to see the possibility of nirvana, liberation, and if you are able to actually prove that possibility of nirvana, then you may be also prove omniscient state of Buddhahood. And so, even if we are not able to realize the cessation, I mean, we can still understand this. But based on the understanding of emptiness, so we are under the power of ignorance. And so with the understanding of emptiness, what helps is what happens is you understand that ignorance is a distorted view, a misconception. And because of this, the other inappropriate perceptions and thought processes, like inappropriate mentations, happen. And so this is something that we can actually, if we really give thought to the teachings like this, we can actually see that it is true. And therefore, the more you dislike this true grasping at true existence that is within yourself, then you will also be able to see how other sentient beings are also overpowered by, enslaved by this ignorance, grasping at true existence. And so, if we really think, we can see that this true grasping at true existence actually damages us, ruins us. So although we may not be able to do so in a very powerful manner, but to a certain extent, we will be able to do that. And so we will be able to see that other things like that are conventional actually have effect on in our life. So things do appear to us as if they have some kind of independent objective existence, and therefore some philosophical traditions actually deliberately try to prove that this is true. What appears to us, this true existence and thing, objective existence, is true. Although we all sentient beings across the expanse of space do not want suffering, but want happiness. And therefore, as Master Tsongkhapa says, that by actually reinforcing this true grasping at true existence through philosophical views, reasons, what you are doing is actually you are reinforcing this, and through the philosophical assertions, and that actually. Actually, it's like inviting more troubles and problems to yourself. And so when you see this kind of condition of sentient beings being overpowered by such true grasping as true existence, then you will naturally feel compassion towards that. So when you have such a compassion, then this will not be an afflicted compassion. So there may be, and we can say that there is an afflicted aspect of an aspect of compassion which is afflicted, and another one which is not. And so by seeing things as like illusion, so by this illusion which confuses sentient beings, and the sentient beings are confused and in the samsara, as the Jalachakra Tantra says. So without actually understanding what suffering is, and not being able to see that it is possible to overcome the suffering, then you may just wish to go out of suffering, but you will not know how to. But when you actually see what suffering is, and then see that the cause of suffering is something which we can actually uproot, then you'll be able to see that those who are actually overpowered by this grasping at true existence and afflictive emotions and so forth, and you will feel compassion towards them. And so that that the path comprising the wisdom and skillful means based on the two truths, and you will be able to see that this leads to the omniscient state of Buddhahood, and therefore Buddha, you can see the Buddha is someone unique. And then Tsongkhapa also says that the Buddha has shown us the path from his own experience, and therefore he is the peerless or the matchless teacher. So although Jerembuche has heard the teaching of the Buddha from his childhood and also had great conviction and then pursued the teaching, the practices, and then he practiced the Dharma, and therefore he says in his three principal aspects of the path, when the two occur not successfully but concomitantly, and mere sight of an infallible dependent arising give rise to an ascertainment that destroys the mode of apprehension of the object, then analysis of the view is complete. And then when you see the import of such teachings, well, this kind of teaching was, of course, advised to Thakombong Awan Thakwa by Master Tsongkhapa. And then when you really understand the teaching through these kind of logic and reasoning, then you will be able to see the real meaning of considering or regarding the master as, perceiving the master as a Buddha. So people, the monastics here, are actually engaging in the study of the great classic texts. So unless you are able to actually make these teachings that are found in the classic text to practice so that you are able to overpower the grasping and true existence, then that you will not actually find any other text for such means. So I read different classic texts like the Master Tsongkhapa's commentaries on Madhyamaka Avatara and also Mudha Madhyamaka Karika. And so when it comes to actually applying that these teachings found in the classic texts, then we have in a sequential manner, then we have the Lamrim text. So we need all the different materials in order to build a house. So the materials are in these classic texts, and then you need to put them together in order to build a good house. And as you find the sequence taught in the Lamrim. So I wish to say this.
Oh yeah, that's it. Church Lam Jin Bei. Chi Jin Gado Chawa.
So from amongst the eight, what are known as the eight great guidance texts of Lamrim, the stage of the path to enlightenment. So in order to listen to this teaching, have the motivation of bodhicitta in order to become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings. And you need to couple bodhicitta with the so we are on the part of the fifth Dalai Lama's text. We have reached the path pertaining to be great beings. So in order to train your mind in this, the Adisha's verse is quoted. So it says those who, based on their personal suffering, want only to eradicate all the suffering borne by others are known as superior beings. So even if you were to attain the arhatship of the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhayanas, you will not be able to fulfill the interest of others completely. So by practicing, by basing your practice on the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, you may be able to attain nirvana. So by therefore by entering into the path of the Mahayana, you need to serve the sentient beings. So someone suggested, His Holiness, reported His Holiness that we have not finished the Benjamin Baldinish's text. We have not finished the part of training the mind in the path to the intermediate beings, common to the intermediate beings. So it has two parts, generating the wish to liberation, and then the establishing the nature of the path to journey there. And the first one has two parts, how to practice during the actual session, and how to practice during the post-meditation sessions. And so you visualize your master on your crown and think that all sentient beings, including myself, are suffering intensely in the samsara is because of not being able to see the nature of suffering, samsara as suffering. And therefore, you make your prayer to the Lama deity to bless you to have this intense wish to go out of suffering, to reach nirvana. And especially for oneself and others to see that the whole of samsara as nature of suffering. And then in the actual part of meditation, there are two sections passed to it. Contemplating the samsara, suffering of samsara in general, and contemplating the sufferings, specific sufferings. So as long as you are in under the power of karma and delusions, you are there's suffering. And then, with regard to the different forms of life in samsara, there's no certainty, such as your father in this life may become, after his death, may be born as your child, and then your sworn enemies in the earlier part of your life may be your best friend, and your best friend may turn as your sworn enemies in the latter part of your life. And so there's no certainty in samsara, the situations with different beings. And so however much you try to enjoy these samsaric pleasures, there is no end to your desire. So you will never be contented, and you will want more. You will search for more pleasure and joy in samsara. And so this is another suffering of not feeling contented. And then, however beautiful body you may have attained in samsara, in the end you would have to discard it. As the Nagarjuna's friendly letter says, so even Indra, who is worshipped by the world, will fall down in samsara due to his karma. And then Chakravartin kings also becomes the lowest kind of servant of others in the end. And so it also says that the ordinary beings have become mother to each other, and during those times the milk that you have that you have suckled from your mother and is more than the amount of the water in the oceans. And therefore, since this is, we have gone through all kinds of sufferings in samsara, if you don't put effort and if you don't put effort in cultivating their path, that there will be no end to this kind of suffering in samsara. And then we have also become enemies to each other, where we have chopped off our hats. And all these hats that we have chopped off of our enemies, if they were to be piled up, it will exceed the height of this universe. The Brahma land. And then the tears that we have shed over the death of our relatives and friends and so forth would also be fill up it will be greater than the oceans. So today I feel slightly upset, my system, and I feel a little bit upset, disturbance in the elements. So I'm taking Tang, Tibetan medicine. So there is a new video screen. So I'm talking to myself
on
to this video screen, the television screen. Please take this tongue.
Oh yeah.
So in the sutra, which says, so this about the suffering, and then the specific sufferings of samsara. So when you have slight wealth, then people actually come forward as if they are taxing, levying tax on you. And then in order to protect your wealth, you will seek help of higher people with higher power and so forth. So when you here also you visualize your guru deity on your crown, and then do the meditations. So as long as this kind of body and mind, which come through the force of delusions and karma, there is suffering, nature of suffering is always there. And therefore, what need is there to mention about the suffering of the lower realms of existence, the unfortunate realms? And so in this human body, the human mind and body that we have attained, there is suffering of hunger and thirst. And then disregarding all kinds of bad reputations and evil actions, you would also try to gain more wealth through various devious means. So when you attain, when you actually obtain those wealth that you seek, and there will be people coming to you as if they were going after some kind of a tax. And then there will be people who will steal your wealth, and someone will come to also ask loan from you and so forth, and then you will not be able to actually give them what they ask. And even if, despite this wish, despite not wanting to give them loan and so forth, you still have to give them, and there's suffering there. And then there is the suffering of being separated from the near and dear ones. And then when you are separated from your lamas, your relatives, your friends, and so forth, you feel suffering. You suffer there again, a great sorrow. And then you actually cry in agony. And then you actually pull on your hairs. And so there is physical suffering like this. And then you'll meet with adversaries, unwanted adversaries. So as soon as you meet such people, there's darkness all around you, suffering as if the darkness enshrouds you. And then when the enemy or the adversary goes to some other place, goes away from there, then you will feel as if there's a sunshine. And when the enemy actually punishes you, so you will also have sufferings of being punished by the adversary, the enemy, or the suspicion that or the fear that this person will punish you. And then not meeting, not finding what you actually search for, there is also the suffering of that. So because of not having accumulated your merit in the past lives, you are poor, impoverished in this life. So you are impoverished and do not have food, clothing, and even if you may do some farming, you will not have harvest, and you do business, you cannot have profit. You do business, and then you may look after animals, the cattle, and then you will not have the cattle are not able to give birth to your babies and so forth, so you don't have more of those cattle. Then you will not meet with people who would actually loan you money. And then even if you actually beg for money and so forth, there will not be people giving you such things, money and so forth. So you remain helpless, being able to do really nothing. And the people whom you have been kind in the past, to such people you may also have to become their servants because of your poor situation, the destitution. So there are lots of sufferings like that in samsara. And then you'll meet, you also have the suffering of meeting with things that you don't desire, such as being punished by the kings and robbed or killed and bound by kings and also robbed by or killed by robbers and so forth. Also have the fear of being meted out with these punishments and murder and so forth. And then there is the suffering of birth, and also the suffering of death. So, since ignorance is the root of all suffering, therefore you need to overcome this grasping at true existence of a self and mine-ness, So you think you should contemplate the suffering of the samsara in general, and samsara as a whole, and seek the path to liberation. And the three trainings must be applied within yourself to overcome the suffering and its causes. And so, during the meditation session, you think about these different sufferings, and then at the time of the in-between sessions, when you leave the meditation session itself, during the post-meditation sessions, you should also think about the reflect on the sufferings of sentient beings or the samsara, and seeing the nature of samsara as being suffering. And read texts such as the scriptures, the words of the Buddha, and also their commentaries. And then, with regards to the establishing the nature of the path leading to liberation. There are also two paths to it, how to practice during the actual meditation session and then what to do in the post-meditation session. The first has preparation, actual practice, and the conclusion. And with regard to the first one, you go through the prayers, which says, I make supplication to the Munindra Vajradhara, who is my guru deity, who is the embodiment of all the objects of refuge, and so on. And then you should think that I and all sentient beings have suffered in samsara. And since we were born in samsara for so long, and we have suffered intense suffering, and various sufferings in samsara, and so forth, you should have this cultivation and the determination to go out of samsara. And so, through concentration, practice of concentration and reading scriptures, one should actually make this life meaningful. And merely wearing the robes, you should not be content with this. And so this really helps me. So as it is said by the Arahat Sagalha, and so with regards to concentration practice and also reading texts, he says that one has to spend one's life on a daily basis, spending time in concentration practice as well as reading scriptures, but merely wearing this, one should not be content merely being able to wear this the three robes of monastics. So having left householder's life and becoming having become celibate, and you should not just be content with these robes alone, wearing the robes alone, but we should actually engage in the practice and study and practice of the Dharma. And we should also look up at the role model of our the Buddha himself, who has gone through the 6 years of austerity, of which we can see statues. And we can see in Bodh Gaya, people, business people, selling these statues of a Buddha, in austerity. So the real statue is actually in Lahore Museum in Pakistan. And a picture of this Buddha. the initiated Buddha was used to be in Porong Potala. So this was not there when I came to India in the beginning, but when I once went to Japan, there was an exhibition of some artifacts, ancient things, from Lahore Museum, and so I saw this statue of the Buddha, the emaciated Buddha statue, and it reminded me of how the Buddha actually went through hardships. And so we, of course, when it comes to doing our practice, we just rather do it very and take it easy. And so later on, I also got a picture of this Buddha from the Lahore, the statue from Lahore. And this statue is these days, we can find the replicas of this being sold in places. And so the Buddha, in the eyes of the parlance, common parlance of the common people, so we are, of course, very ordinary sentient beings. And so we need to really look up at the Buddha and strive in the path, in practice. And so we should, as the Arhat Sagalha says, we need to really practice and read scriptures and not be contented with merely wearing the robes. So we are going through the different courses which leads us to create negative actions or go against the vows. And so, of course, there are people who do not follow Buddhism, and then there are some in this world who actually always try to find some fault in the teaching of the Buddha, and therefore we need to be conscientious, and we need to actually practice feeling shame and embarrassment if we go against our practice. And so we should not think that, of course, in the past, Tibetans usually have this tradition of looking at the monks and nuns and having some kind of a respect, even if they go against the vows. I mean, people say, try to look from the positive angle, but this will not be the case. This is not the case anymore in today's world. People will not say, oh, this may be because of such and such that he's doing. There's no nothing wrong there, and so forth. And so, so we need to think about the 12 links of dependent originations, and then base ourselves in the practice of morality and keeping our vows and precepts pure, untainted. So with this, we have done with the practices pertaining, which are shared with the beings of intermediate scope. Benjamin Peldenish's text. Now we are switching to
Takibu Chamber,
So again, the quotation from the Lamb for the Path of Enlightenment is given, and for pertaining to the beings of great scope.
And
so, so having developed this genuine wish to go out of to aspire for liberation, and one may be able to lead oneself onto this peace of nirvana, but the purpose of teaching this, training our mind in the path which is shared with the beings of the intermediate scope, is just as by inferring from our own suffering, and we should be able to feel the suffering of other sentient beings unbearable, and therefore we should develop this wish and aspiration to lead other sentient beings out of suffering, and therefore the means to that is the path of the great beings. So how do we actually accomplish that goal is mentioned in the concise Prajnaparamita Sutra. So however great qualities you may have regarding morality, concentration, and wisdom, you will not still become Mahayana practitioner. You'll not be one of the Mahayana practitioners yet. So we need the understanding of emptiness, of course, is a common means or the method or common means for both nirvana and omniscience, but the unique course to lead us to Buddhahood is this bodhicitta, like a father, whereas some one person can have three children from three different mothers, but then the main lineage of the fathers is like that is the bodhicitta. So finding the decline of Mahayana teachings unbearable, and then finding it how rare it is to find someone cultivating even the wish to become enlightened, reach nirvana, and how rare it is, how rarer it is that someone actually cultivates bodhicitta. I mean, you can also, inspired by that, you can, one may develop bodhicitta. So being acquainted with bodhicitta in the past life And then there are other factors which would also lead you to cultivate bodhicitta. So with regard to cultivation of bodhicitta, there are the two traditions which have come down from Master Atisha, and also the, which is the 7-point instruction of cause and effect, and also the practice of exchanging and equalizing, equaling and exchanging self and others. So with regard to the 7-point instruction, there is it says that the great compassion is not necessarily comes not necessarily between loving kindness and the extraordinary resolve. So in order to develop great compassion, you need to see all sentient beings as your mother and find them dear to you. So great compassion is the wish for sentient beings to be out of suffering, free from suffering. There's a mere wish for that, but then there's a... And also, not just leaving it at that wish, but actually going forth and taking the making the determination to free them by yourself. And so, in order for this to happen, you need to know what suffering is. The suffering of suffering, you don't only have that wish to be out of suffering, nor the changeable suffering, but mainly the pervasive conditioning existential suffering. And so the Buddha, giving so much emphasis on teaching about suffering, of this kind of suffering, as Panchen Lobsang Chögyen says, this changeable suffering is something even the non-Buddhists are able to become aware of, being unwanted. And therefore, they are not wanting this changeable suffering. They try and pursue the paths, the means, leading themselves to the higher realms of existence. And therefore, one needs to understand what suffering is, and mainly the pervasive conditioning, existential suffering. And that leads one to have this great compassion. So for that compassion, of course, you need to have the seeing sentient beings as being dear to you. And so there are two ways of cultivating this affectionate love. And through the 7-point instruction and also equaling and exchanging self and others. And so in order to have great compassion, you need to see all sentient beings as attractive to you, dear to you. So a partial compassion may be experienced by you, which is like can be biological. So because we have this kind of body, and in order to sustain ourselves, we need some kind of love from others, whether we are born from eggs or from the womb. The child needs the mother's care and nurturing. For that, without there being some affection from the mother will not take care of the child. So even the birds and insects and so forth take care of their babies, their offsprings. And then similarly, dogs, cats, and so forth, and human beings, of course. So mammals and those born from eggs and so forth, the child is nurtured by the mother's care and affection. The greater they receive the care and affection from the mother, the greater, the better their upbringing. So even scientists from their own research and experiments are able to see this. And so this is something empirical to us. So this is a story. There was an international Buddhist conference. It was a small gathering in Delhi. It was an interfaith dialogue. There was a Muslim. And then the Pho Tutu was there from the Christian side. And then from the Hindu tradition, there was Dr. Karan Singh. And then I was there. And so Dr. Karan Singh, I knew him since 1956. So I jokingly said that Karan Singh was born a prince. And he was taken care of by under very excellent conditions. He was brought up. And regarding me, I said, I was born a peasant in Amdo, in a very remote place, in Amdo, in Tibet. And so, I was brought up in such a family. But I said, regarding affection, receiving affection from mother, maybe I may have received more than and you, as a prince, you may not have been breastfed by your mother, but maybe there were ayahs who took care of you and gave you, fed you with milk. So perhaps I told him that I have been breastfed with affectionately more by my mother than you by your mother. And so this doesn't, the affection from a mother to a child doesn't come from some religious belief or some kind of a law, but because of the necessity of this body. And so the greater you have received affection from your own mother, it would have left some seed for affection in your mind stream. And therefore, you are more apt to show compassion towards others. And then today, even the scientists say that the more compassionate and affectionate you are towards others, the better your health will be. Which this is actually something they say from their own experiment and research. So you live under the nurtured by others' affection, and when you are also able to live an affectionate, compassionate life, then you physically you'll be healthier. If you are angry and anxious all the time, they actually harm your health as well. So your immune system, if you are constantly angry or fearful, then they deplete the immune system as well, and they weaken it and deplete them, this immune system. Therefore, the greater your compassionate you are, the more compassionate you are, the physical elements will be in balance, and also it will help to combat the sicknesses, and also your immune system will be strengthened, and that in turn helps you to fight an antibodies. The virus and so forth. So in certain cases, for example, the turtles, the mother comes to the shore of the ocean and gives, lays the eggs and then goes away. So there's no opportunity for the child, the baby turtle, to meet with the mother again. And therefore, it doesn't need to depend on the mother's affection. And therefore, in such cases, even if you were to bring the mother who laid the egg and the child turtle together, maybe they will not know how to show affection to each other. So I've told people to actually do this experiment where the child is not dependent for its upbringing on the mother. I have told people that if you bring this turtle mother turtle with the mother, the child turtle, they will not be able to exchange affection and love towards each other. And therefore, we need affection to nurture and upbring for our upbringing, and therefore the mother becomes affectionate to its child because of this biological condition. And therefore this kind of compassion is, as mentioned here, is partial. So this doesn't arise in relation to someone whom you call an enemy. And not only that, you actually wish them to have more suffering and be called devoid of happiness. So we need to cultivate a compassion which at least can cover all human beings, at the least, even if we may not think about the whole of the entire sentient being. And therefore, when it comes to such a practice, all the religious traditions have this kind of practice of compassion extending to all the entire humanity. And so, seeing that cherishing oneself is the cause of all suffering and cherishing others is the source of all happiness, we try to develop this kind of compassion towards others. So by seeing the pros and cons of cherishing self and cherishing others, we should develop this unbiased, impartial compassion and love or affection towards all sentient beings. And when you are able to develop this, then this can extend to all sentient beings. First, to all sentient beings, and then extending further, you will be able to have this kind of compassion towards all sentient beings. So this kind of compassion should come to us through by using our intelligence, wisdom, and this is not partial kind of compassion. So whether you go about with this kind of cultivation of compassion and so forth through the 7-point instruction or this equivalent exchange self and others, you need to base on this equanimity. So in the case of cultivating the compassion through exchanging self and others, we see the fact that all sentient beings are same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Whereas in the case of the 7-point practice, we develop this equanimity differently. And I'm switching.
So the partial loving kindness that we have in any of us is much related to what is diluted by the attachment towards our love and the dear ones. So the kind of the loving kindness that which we cannot generate towards our enemies and those who are neutral to us. So this kind of loving kindness we can term as partial. So the loving kindness that we speak about in the 7-point cause and effect is something which should not be, which should not be diluted, or we should not, that should not arise from desire and attachment to one's living, one's loved ones and the near ones. So the practice of equanimity, first, the importance of the practice of equanimity is to have a sense of equal towards all the sentient beings, irrespective of whether one happens to be the loved one or the enemies. And so the way to start such kind of practice, so first we have to start from one's love and the near ones. So the reason why it is being stated that we have to focus such kind of equanimity or the loving kindness first from one's love and the dear ones is that in that way, since we are very much related to one's loved ones and the near ones, so in this way, it is much easier to develop such kind of aspiration and loving kindness towards one's families and the near ones. So after that, gradually one has to practice further until the mind of the loving kindness and the great compassion encompasses all the mother sentient beings. And in some ways, the person whom we refer to or consider as one's enemy for this life has been one of our loved ones in our previous life. And so even though those one who consider as our dear and loved one in this life has been one of the worst enemies in our previous lives. So if we contemplate in this way, then it will be easy for us to develop the mind of equanimity towards all. So having a mind of equanimity towards all, then gradually we have to remember the kindness that those mother sentient beings have done to us. And so in that way, we should develop a mind that wish to help or benefit all the mother sentient beings. And since there is no end, since the samsaric world is beginningless, and also in terms of one's own life, there is not such a point that we can point as the starting where we first came into this samsaric world. So therefore, from the day or from the moment that we are here in the samsaric world, so we have been always nurtured by the love and kindness of one's mother. We can all think about how the mother of this life is very kind to us. So similarly, we can think about the same kindness that's been also done by the previous mothers. So as a child, our mother has taken a great care of us, from even the small and the tiny things to make sure that there is no harm being done to us. And as we grow up, and also if we think about the time that we stay in the mother's womb for over 10 months, and the mother, even while you were in her womb, she took a great care of what she eats and drink. So and if we look at the birds and the offsprings, so of course, even though the mother sacrificed their life in order to protect the offsprings. Also, if we looked at animals, the deers, and when the lions and the tigers came to attack the deers, so of course, the deer mother, even though they are uneducated, they're full of ignorance, but even it is very sad that we see that in order to protect their offsprings and the babies, they sacrifice their own life. And in this way, we can think about the kindness that all the mother sentient beings has done for us. And I think it was in early 1960s or 1959. I think it was in 1960 in Dharamsala. And we have a kind of a container made out of a wooden container, and we planted some flowers, and there some butterflies came and laid their eggs upon in the Swarg Ashram. The place was in Swarg Ashram. So while the butterfly, the legs, even the mother would not stay protecting the eggs. So, but the mother, as soon as the offsprings came out of their eggs, so she knows that she lays her egg on a certain flower or a leaf, where once the offspring, once they're out of the egg, they can depend on or they can get their food from the flower. So she also laid the eggs in a circle together. So when the offsprings come out of the eggs, so maybe there is a little difference who comes first or the later in terms of a few minutes, but they all evolve from the egg almost at the same time. And if I touch a little bit with my finger to one of those offsprings, and they all together rise in order to protect themselves. So of course, so these are the mother sentient beings, of course, whom we should be compassionate towards. So even these small insects, so they, in order to protect themselves, even just for their survival, since they need to stay together, so they always protect themselves staying together. And also when I investigate and examine about the small insects, like the bees, so when I try to touch them, of course, they fly away. in order to protect them. So these are really very sad. And even though they have no understanding about the importance of the life, or no understanding as we humans, but in order to preserve their living and preserve their life, they form a circle of their own company. And even though they wish to protect each other, but due to ignorance, they always end up being a prey to some other predators. And of course, in terms of the teachings of the Lord Buddha, so they have no opportunities at all in order to receive any kind of teachings. So when we look at such small insects, of course, it is very difficult to think them as one of your mothers in one of your lives. But of course, we can generate a mind that as the same as we are human beings, of course, they are also by naturally wanting happiness and do not want suffering. So for someone, of course, the 7-point cause and effect is very effective. But for me, the practice of exchanging self and other is more effective. So looking at all these mother sentient beings, so we have to think that now I am their son, and so I have the responsibility to help them, to liberate them from the sufferings. So when I have the potential to liberate and to help all the mother sentient beings, and even though I have such capabilities, then if I stay without thinking about the mother sentient beings, or without or just leaving them behind, then of course it is really something very sad. And how one can benefit this mother sentient being is to giving the food to those who are hungry, and giving water to those who are thirsty, and in nowadays giving medicine to those native ones, and of course giving foods and everyone to the all part of the world who are in need. And I just heard this morning from BBC in Somalia and Africa, due to their civil conflicts, of course some parents ran away and some were killed, though the deserted children who were left without their parents or whose parents has been killed, so there are even hundreds and thousands of such children. So those children are really an object of our love and compassion. So those who help others through the means of providing food and clothes to wear is really helping a kind of really a practice which is really effective. So, but being a practitioner of Buddhist or any kind of other traditions, so it is not much effective to just clear or just help with the immediate or the temporary sufferings. So being a practitioner of Lord Buddha, being a follower of Lord Buddha, of course, we have to think about the origin of all these sufferings, and we have to strive towards bringing them closer towards eliminating the root of the suffering and bringing them closer to the truth of cessation or to moksha. So even this numberless number of sentient beings have been the king of all the gods and goddesses like Brahma and Indra, And even though they have the great pleasures for thousands and millions of life, but due to the contaminated nature of those happiness and those desires, they are reborn again to the lower rebirths. So having thinking about in such way, we have to generate a mind that I will bring all the sentient beings to the state of enlightenment. And having set up such a foundation to generate a mind that aspires for enlightenment, so that itself is not enough, and we have to strive further in order to actualize the mind itself within us. And if someone has the mind of compassion and the mercy and love towards sentient beings, of course, we ourselves can be more proud, and it will help us get encouraged. And once we have the proud and encouragement, then we do not feel frightened or isolated. So even though the other person may not respond in the same way, as they may be different, but from our side, since we have a mind of compassion and love towards everyone, so that will, of course, ultimately generate a very well-being in ourselves. So other than that, if we always think about the self as the most important, then we will develop suspicion even to the friends on the right and the left side. In that way, it will bring a lot of fright to ourselves, and the peace of our mind will be disturbed. So if we practice the loving kindness, through it, the peace of mind will come. And of course, the friends, the companions will flock to you. And in terms of the life itself, we will have a very meaningful life, a life which is more happy, with more companions and friends, and we can always have a smiling face towards everyone. So in terms of reality, the more the person is happy and calm, of course his physical body will be also better in terms of health. If the body itself, in terms of the four elements and others, maintained in a very steady way, then of course it will bring a great sense of happiness to the mind as itself. So the body itself has the potential to bring happiness to the mind. So even those selfless, those non-living beings as the flowers and the trees, so they have a potential for themselves to drive away the obstacles which bring obstacles to their growth and development. So if these non-living beings like flowers even have such capabilities, of course, we human beings and the sentient beings do have such possibilities. So thinking in such way, even though the mother of this life may not have very severe suffering, like the suffering of suffering or the suffering subject to change, but of course our mothers will be under the pervasive conditioning sufferings. So in this way, we have to aspire in order to liberate them from the third form of suffering, which is the pervasive conditioning suffering. And in terms of the lower rebirths, the suffering of suffering such as pain are very evident. And in terms of the higher rebirth, like the gods and humans, the suffering subject to change will be evident. And whatever the sentient beings whom we regard or consider as one's mother, even though they may endure religion negativities and they may bring harm to us. But we have to think in such a way that it may be due to my own past negative karmas by which I'm experiencing this. Or maybe in other way, we can contemplate in such a way that the mother, the sentient being whom we can consider as one's mother, who even though she brings harm to you, but we can think that it is due to her own afflicted emotions, and she is under the influence of her own afflicted anger and desire by which she is harming you. So thinking in this way, one should continuously contemplate and strive towards generating the mind of being all the sentient being as one's mother. So in this way, we have to meditate in such a way that may all sentient beings be free from all the sufferings, and may they have the permanent and the ultimate happiness. And the part which is common to the smaller person and the great, the middling person is something that we can practice in terms of one's own experience. And now, having such a kind of a loving kindness towards all sentient beings, then one should strive towards generating the great compassion. The compassion which strives to liberate all the sentient beings from the suffering of the great oceans. And one should have the very strong determination that may I be the cause to liberate all the sentient beings from all the sufferings, and may I be the cause that brings happiness to all the sentient beings. So we have to think in such way for many times. So even though we may have the wish to bring all the sentient beings to the state of liberation, even at the first level of the practice of the seven pieces, cause and effect, the second one, remembering the mother's kindness, then what is the difference of that kind of mind at the first level and at the end level, or the seventh level during the great compassion? So at the initial level, we may not have that great courage or the determination that we oneself will be the cause to liberate all sentient beings. So as for one's practice, of course, we have to practice combinedly the seven-point cause and effect and the practice of exchanging self and other. So having generated the great compassion, so which completes the seven-point cause and effect, so how should one work towards the practice of exchanging self and others? We have to contemplate, as it is stated in the engaging in the Disa Bodhisattva, that whatever the happiness that we have in this life, it is due to the other sentient beings. And whatever the sufferings that we have, it happens due to the self-centered failing. So therefore, look at the Lord Buddha, who is always working and benefiting others, and ultimately he is much happier than any one of us. So thinking about the present situation of ourselves, it will be very difficult. We may feel or think that it is very difficult to the practice of contemplating the exchanging of self with others. But it is said that once you are trained, once you are accustomed to such practice, then of course it will be easier as the time and the days goes on. So the sense of the mind while looking at one's enemy, so before contemplating such a mind, when we have such kind of mind towards one enemy, so that kind of mind can be gradually converted, bring towards the affectionate mind towards that same enemy. And in terms of the person life, it is also due to the feeling, the mind benefit, mind that aspire to benefit other people. So if we are under the influence of the self-centered feeling, then of course there won't be an ultimate happiness for us. So even the next and the subsequent life also, it has to come through the mind that benefits others. So if one have the stronger mind that wish to benefit others, so from that also the wisdom that realizing emptiness will also arise. So if we are not able to exchange the self with the others, or exchanging one's happiness with others' suffering, then there is no possibility to have any ultimate happiness in this samsaric world. So in this way, we should train in the practice of bodhicitta. So once we have the train, once we train in the mind that wish for enlightenment, then of course it is a starting point of the great path for us. So having, as it is stated, that once we have the practice of great bodhicitta, the from there onwards there won't be any sorrows and suffering. And it is stated in the Guru Puja also that even for the one sentient beings, I will stay in the hotel for eons and eons. So such kind of minds, of course, if they are partial, cannot happen, or they cannot be happened by force or summon. So by thinking about the beneficial factors and thinking about its results, then of course we will be able to generate such kind of mind. So when we speak about the exchanging self with other, it doesn't mean the exchanging the person, for example, the Devadatta, and the person who has the name of Devadatta, and when we speak about exchanging self, it doesn't mean that he's exchanging his name Devadatta with someone else. The point here is to the same amount of the caring that we have for ourselves, then we are able to exchange the same level and same intensity towards other people. So if there is not possibility to have the exchanging of self with other, and also having a self-centered feeling at the same time, so then of course we have to let go of the feeling of the self-centered, or feeling the self is more important. So if we are able to train in this way, then gradually, by getting accustomed to it, gradually such kind of mind will arise without much effort. So also one of the ways to practice the self of exchanging self with other, so the other way to practice is what we call the giving and taking, the Tonglen practice. And this is the so may all my virtues be ripened in order to benefit others. So this is the verse from the Precious Garland by Nagarjuna. So maybe it is a mistake here that the Precious Garland's quote has been erased here. So the fifth Dalai Lama is actually very honest, and we can see in his life story.
So
So he says that the prayer of Samantarabhatra prayers, so he has not memorized it, so he cannot recite it by heart without looking at the text. So maybe Fifth Dalai Lama has taught that this verse may be a verse of Bodhicharya Avatara, so even though this is a verse from Nagarjuna's precious garland. So the practice of the giving and taking is based on, at the initial stage, we can base it on the breathing in and out. From taking breath from the one's right nostrils, thinking about taking all the sufferings of the mother sentient beings, then letting go the breath from the nose, from the left nostrils, thinking about giving away one's prosperity and benefits to all the sentient beings. Or else, we can also think from the second nostrils that when the breath goes out, all the sufferings that is within the mother sentient beings are clear and eliminated. And when we recite the Guru Bhuja, we also to meditate about the giving and taking with the verse that the kindness of the all the our teachers. And some prisoners, Tibetan prisoners in Tibet, so when they undergo huge sufferings and problems, so they meditate this simple practice of giving and taking. And even though it may not be benefit to much to others, but of course it helps them a lot in their thinking. And in particular, of course, if we practice the giving and taking, it will help a lot towards generating a calm mind towards one who consider you as their enemy. So it's the intermediary verse here. It reads that the ocean of the great samsara, and having, in order to liberate from such an ocean of suffering, we have to generate a mind of renunciations through the joyous effort and with the staircase of the three trainings. So one will be able to reach the ultimate peace house of liberation. And since that cannot be done individually, of course we have to rely on our companions and the numberless mother sentient beings. And having seen all those sentient beings who are actually your mother, who undergo such sufferings, of course one has to generate a mind to liberate them. So the next is how to take the bodhicitta through ritual. So having trained in the mind of bodhicitta, so in order to be generate a profound and complete mind for enlightenment, we have to take it through a ritual. And for that, for the preparatory, of course, we have to take the refuge prayers. Then also we have to strive towards accumulation of merits and elimination of our negative karmas. And as for the actual ritual, we have to take it through a certain verse, and at the end, we have to dedicate the merits in order to benefit the numberless mother sentient beings. So these are all stated clearly in the small, the concise, and the middle lamrim. And the bodhicitta itself can be categorized into two, the aspirational bodhicitta and the engaging bodhicitta, depending upon the combating factors that comes with the mind that wish for enlightenment. And the difference is, as it is stated in the engaging in the discipline of Bodhisattva, that there is a difference between one aspiring to go and one that actually goes. So the aspirational bodhicitta is the one which aspire happiness and enlightenment for the sake of all the sentient beings. And the latter is the one which actually engages in those acts. So in order to take the vows of Bodhisattva vow, so there are two assertions, and some say that, of course, we have to take the Bodhisattva vow first before one enters the path of accumulation. And other schools say that one can take the vows of Bodhisattva after we are in the first path of accumulations. So even though we may have disagreement with these two views, but it is not certain, because that is depend on the practitioner's view and practitioner's capabilities. So generally, first we attained a complete bodhicitta, the mind for enlightenment. Then later, as we generate the mind for enlightenment, we are considered as the bodhisattvas. One can be considered as bodhisattva who is in the first part of accumulations. And even the first part of accumulation, we divide it into three: the small, the middle, and the great. And as we become bodhisattva, we started from the small path of accumulation. Then as we progress to the middle path of accumulations, we generate the bodhisattva vows. And the bodhisattva vows act as the cause to combine the bodhicitta mind along with the practice of six perfections, which is called the engaging bodhicitta. So we consider that once we have the bodhisattva vows, and if we consider all those beings with the bodhisattva vows as being in the actual path of the Mahayana, then of course we are wrong. So the bodhisattva vows can be taken even by those who are not yet on the path to enlightenment. So in the dissections, it explains about the difference between the two bodhicittas, the aspirational and engaging bodhicittas, and also the factors which need to be combined with the practice of the six perfections and the bodhisattva vows. So the intermediate verse now. So whatever the realizations that we have and the bodhisattvas have, it is due to the practice of the three trainings. So having the practice of the great three trainings, then one will be considered and one has the potential to be on the path to enlightenment, the first path of accumulation. So we will break here for lunch. And in the afternoon session, we will start from how to train, having generated the mind.